needed his cooperation.
To get a tower, you have to have performed a service of great value to the Order, Nick said.
I had. Nick waited. I kept my mouth shut.
What's your relationship with the Grand Master? Nick asked.
I'm not at liberty to answer. Era liked to describe her relationship with the head of the Order as complicated. From my point of view, there was nothing complicated about it. Damien Angevin was desperately in love with my grandmother. After he granted her the first tower, she gave it to me. He found out and presented her with another one, so she would have one of her own just in case. My grandmother liked him. However, her heart belonged to a man who died over 2,000 years ago. Damien knew this, but he was never one to back down from a challenge. Nick leaned back into his chair, doing an excellent impression of a granite boulder.
I've never heard of you, Ms. Ryder.
I'm not famous.
There are only 4 towers in existence, Nick said.
5, but who was counting?
I know all 4 recipients of the tower.
Great, just my luck.
Your tower is registered to you, which means that 1 of the 4 granted you authority to use it. Who do you belong to, Ms. Ryder?
I belonged to New Shinar and to my grandmother, the Plague Bringer, the City Eater, Rigmer Pana Shinar, the voice of the Old Kingdom. In the grand tradition of the royal line, I had earned my share of titles as well, the most famous of which was Dada Nu Edes Shinar, the Strength of the New Shinar. Nick had actually heard of me. He just didn't know it. Mentioning any of this nonsense was out of the question because Nick hated my grandfather, my grandmother, and anything to do with Shinar with the passion of 1,000 suns. The tower compelled the Night Protector to comply, but if he knew who I was, he would make things as difficult as he could. This required tact. Of the 4 tower recipients, Nick would likely view Hannah Salazar as the lesser evil. A former officer, she ran a small private army in New Mexico, and her people had saved the local Order chapter during the last flare at great cost. I belong to someone who values discipline and accountability, Night Protector. I swore an oath to follow orders, and those orders require me to maintain confidentiality. I don't enjoy the Cloak and Dagger Act. I prefer simple missions where the enemy is clear, but this is the way my chain of command wants to play it. So I must do my best. I hope for your understanding. There you go. I am a mercenary with a military mindset. Don't mind me. No deep, dark secrets here. Nick pondered me for a long moment.
Very well. What do you need?
I leaned forward. 3 days ago, a man was murdered. I want to take over the investigation into his death. Nick sighed.
This is Atlanta, Ms. Ryder. Be more specific. Which of the 7 murders on my desk would you like to play with?
Pastor Haywood's. Nick thumbed through the stacks of files on his desk, pulled one out, and offered it to me.
Fine. It's all yours.
Just like that. Huh. Nick studied me.
Is something the matter?
I expected more resistance.
And you will have it, just not from me. How much do you know about Atlanta?
Not as much as I'd like to.
Stay a while, and you'll wish you knew less.
Nick stood up and pulled at a cord hanging from a roll of plastic secured on the back wall. The plastic unrolled into a map of Atlanta with sections tinted with different colors.
The lay of the land, Nick said. At least as of last week. Atlanta is less a city and more a collection of territories claimed by different factions. There are 3 main roads, I-20 that runs east to west, I-85 that runs north to south, and the Peach Loop, which is a new road that circles the city.
He pointed to the northeast, where a gray icon depicted a stylized castle sitting in the middle of an area tinted with green.
The Keep, the headquarters of the Pack. Their territory extends almost to I-85.
Nick tapped a white palace icon located in the northwest, in the loop between I-85 and I-20, colored with red.
The casino. It used to belong to the people, Except now our particular people call themselves the Eastern Institute of Necromancy, also known as EIN. They're still the same people. They still pilot vampires with their minds, finance their research with gambling, and think they're better than everyone else and therefore are entitled to special treatment.
The people had been created by my grandfather. Thousands of years ago, Roland accidentally made the first vampire, and when he awoke in the modern age, he decided to make good use of them. Before his exile, he established the People, an organization of necromancers capable of piloting vampires with their minds. He gave them a modern name because Navigator sounded a lot less scary than Necromancer, and sent them into the world. The People positioned themselves as part corporation, part research institute, and usually owned community entertaining businesses. Casinos were their favorite. Now that Grandfather was no longer in the picture, the People fractured into independent organizations. Atlanta's EIN was more independent than most. During the final fight between Kate and Roland, the Atlanta's People threw their lot in with Kate. A lot of other navigators viewed it as a betrayal. Nick pointed to a gray section centered on a tower.
The Order's territory. You are relatively safe here.
He moved his finger to an area spreading north and south of I-20, stained with so many colors, it looked like an overenthusiastic toddler with finger paints had gone wild after a serious sugar rush.
The Pagans. The Covens are here, the Neo-Vikings over there. Then we have the Druids, the Greeks, the Volves, the Egyptians, the devotees of the traditional African religions.
His hand flickered over the map to the southeast.
The representatives of the Cherokee, Apalachee, Muscogee Creek, and other tribes are here. Also, the major religions each have their own sphere of influence and center of power, dotted throughout the city, with the Christians being the most numerous. Apocalypse or not, we're still in the Bible Belt.
Nick stepped back and waved his hand, encompassing the map.
It's about as fun as it looks. Occasionally, something gets them all united, but most of the time, they can't agree on where the sun will rise tomorrow. They are like rocks in a sack, grinding against each other. They all want to expand, but there is only so much city to go around. So they watch each other, waiting for an opportunity.
What about that smaller blue-green area in the southeast? Nick grimaced.
That's the Lenart Daniels gated community.
Really? Gated community?
Yes. It's very exclusive.
I bet it is. Meaning?
Stay out of there. Lenart once led the pack, and Daniels has claimed, her word, not mine, the entire city in the past. Now they spend most of their time up in Wilmington because their son attends a private school there, but they come back in the summer to visit family and friends. That family is complicated.
You don't say.
They have issues with the pack and EIN, and they are not receptive to outsiders. The entire neighborhood consists of shapeshifter families that left the pack with them. Imagine three streets full of werebears and former pack heavy hitters, fanatically loyal to Lenart and Daniels. If you trespass, I may not be able to get you out.
That was a lie. Nick visited my family on a regular basis. Kate considered him her stepbrother. Conlon called him uncle. Sometimes, when Nick did something particularly boneheaded, Kate referred to him as Uncle Stupidhead, and not always out of his earshot. If one of Nick's knights accidentally happened to wander into their neighborhood and made a mess of things, Kate and Curran would absolutely return the poor lost lamb to Nick. Besides, as the knight protector, Nick could and would go anywhere in the city, and all the bigwigs whose territory he invaded would have to mind their manners when they politely asked him to leave.
While you're at it, keep clear of the Mercenary Guild. Lenart and Daniels don't run it anymore, but they still own a chunk of it, so don't go in there looking for your people.
Well, my ploy to pose as one of Hannah Salazar's private soldiers worked. He thought I was a mercenary. Clearly a profession he wasn't fond of. That and my barging in and taking one of his cases likely meant that if I did get in trouble, the Night Protector wouldn't be in a rush to rescue me. Good thing I didn't often require rescue.
The murder of Pastor Nathan Haywood happened here. Nick touched an area in the southeast, close to the Peach Loop. In no man's land. You have the Warren to the east. It's an impoverished area, full of the homeless and street gangs. The PAD doesn't make many trips to the Warren. Pastor Haywood deliberately chose this neighborhood. He was a true Christian. He lived simply, he was humble, and he worked miracles. This was a man who ministered to anyone in need, especially to the poor. He fed them, he healed them, and he spread the word of his God.
You knew him?
I saw him cure people. He wasn't a fraud.
Post-shift, faith had power. If enough people believed in a god, the deity would grow in power, and sometimes its priests gained magic abilities. Nobody quite knew if those powers were the result of the deity imbuing its chosen with magic, or if the faith of the congregation empowered the clergy directly, but their new abilities were a fact.
Pastor Haywood never took any money or credit for what he did. His magic was faith-based, so it only worked on those who shared his beliefs. But when it worked, it was extraordinary. He was a good man, who thought he had no magic of his own, and saw himself as an instrument of a higher power. Do you know how this kind miracle worker died?
No.
Look in the file.
I opened the file. A colored photograph stared back at me. A stump of a body sprawled in a puddle of blood on the floor. The head was missing, torn off, judging by the ragged shreds of skin around the neck. His chest was a gory mess. Something with vicious claws had ripped him open, breaking his ribs, and their shards jutted out of the red-smeared flesh. Thick, dark blood pooled inside the chest cavity where vital organs used to be.
It took his heart, I said. Yes.
Nick sat back in his chair.
It's too early to say if the culprit is an it. The force and the claws required to open a human being like that could indicate a shapeshifter or a vampire, or half a dozen magical beasts seen recently within the city limits. Your guess is as good as mine.
He sounded bored. Nick didn't know how to be apathetic about his job. He never phoned anything in. But here was a holy man, a pastor he personally knew and clearly admired, murdered in a horrifying way, and Nick was pretending not to care. He wasn't giving me any details either. Why so indifferent, Uncle? What are you hiding? Did he have any enemies? Do you have any leads or suspects?
No and no. Pastor Haywood was beloved by his congregation and respected by his peers. The murder was announced in the paper 2 days ago, and there are still hundreds of mourners standing vigil at the church where he was a deacon.
I studied the photograph and slid it back into the file gently. I had seen plenty of dead bodies. I had made a lot of bodies dead, and sometimes my handiwork looked worse than this. But there was something profoundly sad about Pastor Haywood's murder. The brutality of it, the sheer savagery of it made you want to punch something. He was a man with a kind heart, and someone had literally ripped it out. He was a light in the world. We had so few lights. I traced the body with my fingertips. You won't be forgotten. I promise you, I will find the one responsible and stop them from hurting anyone else. I realized Nick was watching me and closed the file.
The order was asked by the Methodist Bishop of North Georgia to step in because the manner of death makes this case a political time bomb. The PAD was overjoyed to send it over. It landed on my desk this morning. Everything we know is in that file, and now it's yours.
Nick opened a drawer in his desk, took out a form, wrote on it in indecipherable cursive and held it out.
For the purposes of this investigation, we're going to make you a Knight Defender.
Rank and file member of the order. Perfect.
Go down the hall, take a left, second door on the right, give them this paper, and they will make you your very own junior detective badge. While in possession of said badge, You represent the Order of Merciful Aid. Should you fuck up, you'll find me less than merciful. And no matter what favor your superior thinks they're owed, I'll kick your ass right out of Atlanta. Understood?
Right. That's all he was going to give me. Understood. Any advice?
Nick grinned like a wolf baring his fangs. Have fun. Don't offend anybody. And try not to die.
4. 3 minutes after I left the orders chapter, I realized I'd picked up a tail. To be fair, the tail was almost painfully obvious, so it wasn't that much of an achievement. I shifted in the saddle, turning my head slightly. The female knight who'd escorted me to Nick's office was following me on foot, making no effort to hide herself. She must have decided that even if I knew she was there, I couldn't do much about it. I let her follow me down Magnum, across the post-shift bridge that spanned the railroad tracks, and down the narrow Packard Street. Normally, I would have just ignored her and let her merrily tail me wherever, but I was going to the murder scene, and I had a feeling there were things there I didn't want her to see. Packard brought me to Ted Turner Drive, lined with reclamation shops and construction offices. Turner ran next to the ruined downtown. Scavenging the ruins for metal and other usable materials was a big business. The traffic went from non-existent to heavy as the street channeled carts with supplies, craftsmen, and laborers. Both of my parents used to work here. I should have turned south to the right. Instead, I turned north. The buildings at the intersection blocked me from the night's view. I nudged Tulip into a trot. She picked up the pace, nimbly dodging the crowds. A collapsed building loomed on the left, pure white, its four remaining floors rising from the rubble. We reached it, I dismounted, and tapped Tulip's neck. Around the block. She took off down the street. I ducked into a hole in a former office building. From the outside, it looked like the interior had completely collapsed there, but there was a narrow gap on the right if you knew where to look. I squeezed through it, into the gloom, jogged a dozen feet to the inner wall, and jumped up. My hands caught the familiar handholds on pure muscle memory, and I scrambled up all the way to the exposed third floor. I padded to the half-wrecked wall and glanced out of the gap, keeping myself hidden. The female knight jogged out of the traffic and halted below. If she was tracking me by magic, she would have no problem finding me. If she tracked by scent, she would likely follow Tulip. A horse's scent was stronger and easier to track than the rider's. She looked left. She looked right. She looked confused. Lost something? The knight turned in a slow circle, scanning the streets, and went right down Trinity Avenue. Neither magic nor scent then, just plain old eyesight. She'd lost me, and she correctly figured out that I would be going to the crime scene, so instead of wasting time on finding me, she decided to go to the crime scene as well and wait. On paper, Trinity Avenue would be a good way to get to Pastor Haywood's church. But Trinity Avenue ran into Wolf Bridge, which spanned the rubble and crossed over I-85. This time of day, the reclamation teams would be bringing in the first loads of salvage from downtown. At the same time, the Teamsters would be transferring this morning's freight from the North Ley Line to the west. Wolf Bridge would be packed, hoof to bumper. It would cost her at least half an hour, 45 minutes if it was a busy shipping day. She was likely a capable knight. Nick didn't tolerate incompetency. But she spoke with a touch of Upper Midwest, and I'd been running away from monsters on these streets for as long as I could walk. Atlanta was my city. I climbed down and whistled. A few seconds later, Tulip came trotting from around the corner. I mounted and headed south on Turner. 25 minutes later, I dismounted in front of Garden Lane Chapel. If there were gardens here, no trace of them remained. The street bordered the Warren, a patchwork of ruined houses and crumbling apartments that had been hit by magic so many times, everyone who could afford to move had. The neighborhood looked bleak. Abandoned buildings staring at the world with black hole windows, ugly gray lichens on the walls that seemed to suck the color out of the paint and stucco, and black trees.
The trees were the worst, their bark coal black and slightly fuzzy. Even their leaves had turned dark and narrow, sharp enough to cut. Against this backdrop, the chapel all but glowed. White and freshly painted, with a bright red door, it perched on the corner like a beacon of safety. A young cop stood by the door, a gladius on one hip and a service revolver on the other. Traces of magic sometimes lingered even during the tech waves now, and the revolvers tended to misfire less than semi-automatics. Personally, I preferred blades. They always worked. The cop tilted his head, presenting me with a flat expression. In his mid-20s, tan and fit, with blue-black hair, he wasn't a rookie or a veteran putting in time till retirement. He was in the prime of his copness, and the way he stood told me he enjoyed every minute of it. He took in the tattered cloak that hid most of me, the worn saddlebag on Tulip, and the bow protruding from the scabbard attached to her saddle, and classified me as move along. I clearly had no business on this street. I pushed back my hood. He blinked. The flat expression slid off his face. Suddenly, he was alert and professional. He was treating me to his polite, badass persona. The face strikes again. Like many teenage girls, I had gone through a stage when I thought I was the ugliest thing on earth. But by 18, I had realized that I was pretty. I used to have one of those pixie faces that could look beautiful or mousy. My old face was like a simple black dress. I could dress it up or dress it down. That was no longer an option. My new face made an impact no matter what I did to it. Dirty, clean, makeup, no makeup, it didn't matter. The eye I had absorbed reshaped me. Nobody even remembered my old face except me.
"Can I help you, ma'am?"
the cop asked. I pulled out my freshly minted order ID and presented it to him. "I'm here to take this murder off your hands."
"I haven't seen you before. I would have remembered if we met."
His face moved a little. He had considered hitting me with his smooth smile, but decided that the professional colleague angle might work better. "I just transferred." He gave me an understanding look.
"New guys get all the shit jobs."
"Isn't that the truth?" I smiled at him. He raised his eyebrows slightly. I waited, but nothing came out of his mouth. "I would like to see the crime scene, Officer..." I let it hang.
"Officer Fleming. This way."
He opened the red door and walked through. I followed. The inside of the church was clean and bright. Sunshine flooded through the windows and the round skylight right above where the pulpit would have been, so the pastor standing at it would have been bathed in light during the sermon. But the pulpit was nowhere to be found. Fleming strode down the aisle between the pews.
"You're not from around here."
"No," I lied.
"So where is home?"
"Small town out west." He nodded.
"Okay, small town. Forensics has been through the scene, but try not to alter anything. Until your boss signs all the paperwork, this is still our baby, which means it's my head if you screw it up."
He thought I was fresh off the farm. Oh, this would be good. Officer Fleming gave me his serious stare to communicate that he was about to pass on important information.
"I'll give you some background. This area was hammered by magic. You saw the black trees?"
"Yes."
"It gets worse as you go deeper in. Everyone who could afford to move did. The church used to thrive, but after the first couple of flares, they closed it down because everyone had taken off. It sat abandoned for a while. Then Pastor Haywood asked if he could have it to minister to whoever was left in the Warren. They gave it to him. He lived here too, in a little apartment in the back. The church door was never locked. And if you rang the bell on the door in the back, he would come talk to you day or night."
"You knew him?"
"Yes, most people around here knew him. You see all sorts of shit in Atlanta. Most of it makes sense. Someone needs something, food, drugs, wood for the winter, so they steal. Someone gets mad, hurts somebody else. It's bad, but it makes sense. This makes no sense. It's evil."
He halted. The raised platform where the pulpit should have been stood empty, littered with broken glass. Blood stained the pine floorboards, dried to a dark crust. The light streaming through the shattered skylight painted a bright circle in the gore, and the crushed glass glittered like diamonds on burgundy velvet. I glanced around. A heap of broken wooden shards lay crumpled against the left wall, the pulpit. Something had come through the skylight and batted it aside. The pulpit had flown into the wall and splintered into shards.
First time in Atlanta? Fleming asked.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rough city.
You should see L.A. It will turn your hair white overnight.
So I gathered.
It can be tough to get your bearings.
I can see that.
Please, crusty veteran, enlighten this humble rookie.
Have you found a place to stay yet?
Fleming said.
I can recommend a few of the safer areas.
The last thing I needed was him trying to find out where I was staying. I needed to shut this down flat.
The Order likes to keep an eye on us. I'll be in the barracks for a bit.
Let me know when they let you out for recess and I'll show you around.
Recess? I might take you up on that generous offer. He grinned at me.
Happy to help.
I blinked, bringing my magic into focus. Translucent swipes of color appeared. Bright bluish silver, the color of human magic infused with divinity. Pastor Haywood. The flecks and smudges of silver were everywhere, but the bloody platform glowed with it. The twisted cascade of feathery magic stretched from the skylight all the way down, as if someone had taken a radiant spider web woven of pure light, crumpled it together, and dumped it from the skylight onto the floor. A bright trail of green, a familiar shade, led to the platform. Shapeshifters, too recent to have been involved in the murder. I crouched, getting a closer look. One particular ribbon of grass green stood out.
Ugh, just my luck.
Have any shapeshifters been here recently?
No.
Right. They didn't come through the skylight. The trail started at the door. Someone let them in, which meant either the cops owed them a favor or some money had exchanged hands.
Probably both.
I moved closer, into the space between the front rows of pews and the platform. A second shapeshifter trail. These guys did come through the skylight and left only a couple of hours ago. Strange. Two separate crews? Why? A single thread of green in that second trail caught the light, glowing with magic. It was the most beautiful mint green, translucent and pure. The other shapeshifter trails, grass green or hunter, had degraded slightly, fading a little into the environment. But that mint green stayed, still bright and vibrant. If the other traces were watercolor, this was a metallic acrylic. It drew the eye. I had never seen anything like it. As beautiful and strange as it was, the thread was too recent to be connected to the murder. I stepped onto the platform and knelt down, trying to parse the explosion of silver. So much power expended so quickly. Death wasn't instant. Pastor Haywood had come face to face with his attacker, and he'd fought back. The struggle hadn't lasted long, but it was savage and brutal. The magic was too dense. I needed a better point of view. I lay down on my back and looked up into the funnel of silver stretching to the ceiling.
Are you okay? Fleming asked.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the silver was tinted with gold. It spiraled down, feathery and gossamer, mixing with Pastor Haywood's silver blue. Yellow usually meant animal magic, but not always. When Nick went undercover with my grandfather's people, they had forced his body to absorb an alien power, which is why his signature had a yellow streak to it. Still, such light gold. A divine beast?
Remember how I said not to mess with the scene? I don't know how to break this to you, but you're contaminating things all over the place.
Since Pastor Haywood died, 17 people have been at this scene. They walked all around the church, and a couple of them tasted the blood over there.
If you're worried about contamination, that cat is out of the bag.
I crossed the platform to the right, taking care to avoid the blood, and saw a slight shimmer of purple in the corner.
Hello.
I walked over. A sigil was burned into the wooden floorboards. A distorted stick figure with a circle where the head would be and a crescent moon instead of feet. Its right arm pointed up at a 45-degree angle. The left arm continued down, forming an H, while its right simply ended. The sigil glowed with intense, electric lilac. Active. A familiar rage stirred inside me. Moloch's priests didn't kill the pastor, but they defiled his sanctuary by leaving one of their own to watch it and taint it with Moloch's power. This was his holy place, a refuge where Pastor Haywood ministered, and they desecrated it. Why watch a crime scene? What did they want from it? I had to pull Moloch's little helper out of its hidey hole and find out. Depending on who was hiding in the sigil, it could get messy. The female knight would be here any minute. Anything she witnessed would be reported back to Nick, and I wasn't ready to answer the kinds of questions it would raise. I could try to come back tonight, but if the thing hiding in the sigil killed someone before then, I'd never forgive myself. If I was going to break the seal, it had to be now. Getting rid of Officer Jaded Veteran would be a problem. Can you give me some privacy, Officer Fleming?
Nope.
Crap. I need you to step back, please. Fleming took two deliberate steps back. His face told me that was as far as he was willing to go. Doing anything too flashy with him here was out of the question. Fine. I'll be right back. I walked past him, going outside. On the left, some bricks had come loose from a flower bed. That would do. I picked one up and headed back into the church. Fleming was exactly where I had left him. He eyed the paver brick.
Don't break any windows, small town.
I walked up to the sigil, put the brick on the floor, reached into my cloak and found the handle of my knife. It was a simple knife, reminiscent of a Bowie with a 9-inch tool steel blade, full tang, and a stacked leather handle so my hand didn't slip. Officer Fleming?
Yes?
Duck. I yanked my cloak off and dragged my foot across the sigil. A man-sized clump of darkness tore out of it, like a ghost in a mantle of smoke. His hands ended in 3-inch-long black claws, their tips glowing with red-hot fire. A Mavir, one of Moloch's priests. A lesser one. The phantom raked at me. I shied out of the way, letting the claws rend the air a hair from my throat, and stabbed the knife into the phantom's chest, hammering a spike of my magic through it. The knife sank into flesh. I jerked it free. Fire bled through the smoke. The Mavir screeched and spat a torrent of flames. I dodged and slashed again, slicing at the creature's protective cloak, left to right and up. The smoke tore like an old tarp, betraying a glimpse of a charred body wrapped in flames. The phantom flailed, trying to shred me with its claws. Fast, but not fast enough. I spun to the left, around it, bringing my arm in an arch from inside out and buried my blade in its back. The creature shrieked. I gripped the knife, feeding magic into it, and dragged it down, carving through gristle and bone, slicing through the sigils branded on its flesh until I reached the main one in the small of its back. My blade bit into it. The sigil broke and vanished in a flash of lilac. The smoke disappeared, like a length of black chiffon jerked out of sight. Fire burst out of the priest. For an instant, the Mavir was engulfed in flames, a dark thing flailing within an inferno, like a blasphemous demonic candle. He burned and howled. I swiped the brick from the floor. The fire faltered, leaving behind a humanoid shape. Desiccated, charred, bald, with his face covered in a metal mask. I kicked the creature's spine. He went down with a dry crack. I flipped him on his back and smashed the brick into his face. The mask clanged. I hit it again, again, and again with controlled, methodical savagery. The mask cracked. Another hit, The metal split. Chunks of the mask fell apart, revealing a nightmarish face. His lips were gone, teeth bared in a grotesque grin. His nose was a hole in the leathery flesh of its skull. He should have been dead, but somehow he was alive. An abomination wrapped in foul magic, staring at me with wide eyes, its irises full of fire. A raspy sound broke through the priest's teeth, a half-groan, half-snarl, so weak I had to strain to hear it.
"Glory to the King of Fire."
"Your God isn't here," I told him quietly. "He doesn't care. He won't save you."
"He'll come for you. You belong to him. The world belongs to him."
"The world belongs to me and my kind, Mavir." I plunged the knife into his chest and twisted. The priest convulsed, agony twisting his limbs. "Tell me why you are here, and your death will be quick." The Mavir rasped again.
"Mercy."
"You serve the god who feeds on children burned alive in his fire. There is no mercy in the world for you." I twisted the knife again. His shriek lashed my eardrums. "Tell me."
"The priest's killer," he whispered. "Moloch wants it."
"Why?" Fiery eyes stared past me at the piece of sky through the ruined skylight. The magic that gave the Mavir his perverse unlife was bleeding out. He was done. Words of an ancient prayer in a language dead for thousands of years hissed out of the creature's mouth.
"A great Moloch, god among kings, I come to you."
"No." I leaned close, so close I could feel the dying heat rising from the priest, and whispered into his ear in the same tongue as his prayer. "There will be no death rites for you. Die and become nothing." I rose, set the brick on the creature's face, and stomped down on it. A fiery blast wave tore out of the corpse, roaring like an enraged animal. Every window in the church exploded. The building shook once, and then all was quiet. Smoke rose from the front pews, scorched by the heat. The priest's body melted into nothing. Only my knife and the brick remained, stained with soot and lilac magic. That was the problem with killing Mavarim. When one of Moloch's assassin priests died, their magic sullied the weapon that killed them, and worse, others of their kind could track it the way bloodhounds followed a scent. The stain lingered until the next tech wave. I didn't want them to track me. Not yet. I glanced at the lilac splashed on my hands and concentrated. Thin red vapor slid out of me, invisible to the naked eye, cleansing my skin. Didn't work on weapons or clothes, unfortunately. I'd tried. A small noise made me turn to the right. Something moved between the pews. Slowly, gingerly, Officer Fleming stood up. Two wide eyes stared at me from a face smudged with soot. The door burst open, and the female knight tore into the church. "You missed it." I swiped my cloak off the floor, slipped it on, and walked off the platform. She swore. I walked past Fleming. "Sorry about the windows, big town." He gaped at me. I winked at him and headed to the door. 5. I brought Tulip to a halt on the corner of Jonesboro and Gammon Street, two blocks away from Pastor Haywood's church. Around me, black trees crowded the road, their sharp leaves unnaturally still despite a slight breeze. A small two-story building with boarded-up windows perched on the corner to the right, its grimy brown bricks stained with gray mold. Back when I ran the streets, this building served as a rallying point for the North Warren kid gangs. Street kids knew Pastor Haywood. He fed them, he healed them, and he probably had hidden them when the occasion required. I reached into my pocket, pulled out an ounce of silver, and held it up. Silver was the go-to metal for most magic-related work. It was easy to shape, took enchantment better than any other metal, even gold,
and was poisonous to a wide variety of magical creatures, all of which made it hellishly expensive. It could be bought in several forms: dust, rod, bar, and wire. I was holding a 1-ounce bar, 5 centimeters long, 3 centimeters wide, and about as thin as 10 pieces of paper stacked together. On the street, it was worth roughly $50. I tossed the bar into the air and caught it in my fist. Silver! No answer. They knew all the cops in the area, so they realized I wasn't one. I was a stranger, and therefore scary, but I also offered silver. Paper money could be ripped or burned. Some of the older pre-shift notes contained plastic and sometimes fell apart in the magic waves. But silver always held value, and it was easy to hide and sell. Pastor Haywood! I held the bar up. Hurry up, I have things to do. The boarded-up window on the first floor quaked. The entire section swung out, and a figure squirmed out and landed on the grass. A boy ran up to me. 10, maybe 12, skinny, filthy, smelly, his hair a brown mess on his head. A rat's tail hung from a loop on his pants. When I'd left, the rat tails were a small gang on the east side of the Warren. They must have expanded. Light blue eyes looked at me from a grimy face. What do you want to know, lady? I studied the silver in my hand. Did anything strange happen with Pastor Haywood in the last couple of weeks? Silver first! I sneered at him and tensed slightly. Tulip started walking. Wait, wait! The kid jumped in front of my horse. Tulip bared her teeth. I wouldn't if I were you, I told him. She bites. He stepped to the side. A guy came to see him. We know everybody who comes, but we hadn't seen him before. We'd remember him. Why? Tell me about him. I dropped the bar. He snatched it out of the air with a cat-like quickness and let out a squeak. Shutters banged, bushes rustled, and 5 kids closed in, all under 12 years old, all equally filthy. They kept their distance in a ragged semicircle. I took another silver bar out. Tell me about the stranger. Where were you when you saw him? The leader stared at a small child, maybe about 7 or 8, with twigs and beads in her dark hair. Tell her. I saw him, the girl said. Where were you when you saw him? Inside. Why were you inside? Pastor had cookies, the girl said. What kind of cookies? Oatmeal. If you got hurt, he would heal you and give you a cookie. Ah, so that's where this was going. You hurt yourself to get a cookie? She nodded. How? I ran and fell. What happened when you went to see the pastor? He magicked my leg and gave me milk and a cookie. It was this big. She held fingers of her small hands far apart. Did you eat the cookie in the church? She nodded. Then what happened? I was eating the cookie and a fatso came. Fatso meant someone well off, good clothes, expensive jewelry, well fed, a good mark. Did anybody else see the fatso? I asked. The kids shook their heads. That's what I thought. It wasn't we hadn't seen him before. It was she hadn't seen him before. I needed to separate her from them. I'd get more information that way. You know where Central Market is? She nodded. I leaned down and offered the girl my hand. Show me, and you can tell me about the fatso on the way. I'll give you this silver at the end. The leader stepped in front of the girl. No, we don't know you. I added a second ounce to the first. He shook his head. The little girl tried to push past him, and he blocked her. I said no, not safe. A street kid who took care of the younger children. Rare. He was probably new to the life. Some people thought that street kid gangs were like the Lost Boys from Peter Pan. It wasn't like that at all. On the street, it was all about survival. The stronger kids preyed on the weaker ones. This boy wouldn't last long. I pulled out my order badge and showed it to him. I won't hurt her. He stared at the badge, thinking. Okay. Yep, knew. Still trusted law enforcement. I reached down. The little girl grabbed my arm. I lifted her into the saddle in front of me. She weighed nothing. We set off north toward the old I-75.
What did the fatso look like?
Big.
Tall or short?
Tall.
What color hair?
Brown.
Was his skin brown or pale?
Pale.
The little gang was trailing us, trying to be inconspicuous as they darted through the brush past the ruined houses.
What did his face look like?
She frowned.
He had fake eyes. Like he is nice when other people can see him, but not when he's by himself.
Did he look like the kind of guy who would hit you if you stole from him?
She nodded. Her shoulders hunched a little. She'd been hit before, and she'd learned to roll into a ball.
Do you remember what the fatso said to the pastor?
He said he had a holy artifact.
Jackpot.
What kind of holy artifact?
She shook her head.
I don't remember. I wasn't listening good. Pastor and he talked, and then pastor said he would think about it, and the fatso left.
Then what happened?
The next day a car came, and pastor got into it. He never gets into cars. He came back later.
Did he seem okay when he came back?
She nodded.
The next morning, he got killed.
Her voice got really quiet.
He was nice.
He was, and now he was gone. No more milk and cookies. No more healing when you got hurt. She'd lost the only safe place she'd had. She was the smallest and the weakest of the gang. I could feel her ribs rubbing against my arm. Starved. So starved, she'd learned to hurt herself to get food. I wanted to take her off the street. I had to. If I took her with me, where would I put her? I had a job to do. Sooner or later, I'd become a target. Anyone close to me would be a potential hostage. If I left her in the fake, shabby section of the house, she'd get bored and go out. She was a street kid, used to moving around. If I left her in the inner chamber, she wouldn't be able to keep her hands to herself. There were things in that room that could eat her or turn her skin inside out. I had promised my grandmother that I would stop trying to rescue every homeless child I saw off the streets. It was a luxury I didn't have. As a princess of Shinar, my job was to see to all street children, not just the one in front of me, and to enact changes that would ensure no more kids would be thrown away like garbage. I had done that, and the new Shinar was on the way to being a place where no child went hungry. But new Shinar was far away, and the child in my arms was here now. Era had tried to save everyone, and she'd allowed herself to become a monster for the sake of her people. She didn't want me to go down the same road. She said it would unravel my soul thread by thread. My position gave me the ability to bring about sweeping change, and I had to concentrate on that, because not everyone understood all that. But the little girl in front of me was so tiny. Even if she survived for the next couple of years, I knew exactly what lay ahead. Abuse, more abuse, rape, beatings, drugs, death. Few of the kids endured to adulthood, and those who managed it didn't live long. But if the priests of Moloch saw her with me and got their claws on her, they would cook her alive just to hurt me. I had to let her go. Once this was over, I would find her again. What's your name?
Martin.
Usually street kids had nicknames like Rat or Weasel.
Who named you that?
I named me.
Why Martin?
Because they're smart and cute. And fast. You can't catch them.
Squirrels are fast.
Squirrels are dumb. Pine martens eat squirrels.
Fair enough.
There was a blue building on the corner of Harpy Street, Martin. Is it still there? She nodded. I dropped the silver into her grimy hand. They'll take it away from you as soon as I'm gone. Let them have it. She sighed.
Dougie doesn't take our money. Dougie is too nice. He isn't mean. He is...
soft. Martin nodded. She wasn't soft. Not even a little bit. Dougie was bigger and older, but she would last longer. Give him the silver anyway.
She couldn't protect it, and it would only make her a target. Come to the blue building tomorrow. Go through the second doorway. Inside, turn left, count 8 steps. There is a loose board in the floor. I'll leave something there for you. She squinted at me. Keep low for the next few days. If something else weird happens, or if anybody else comes asking about this, hide from them and go straight to the order and ask for Aurelia. They'll keep you safe until I get there. Tell the other kids, too. Anybody shows up with questions about Pastor Haywood, bolt and hide. I let her off the horse. She ran back, skinny legs flying, the silver clutched in her small fist. The little gang closed about her. Dougie wrapped his arm around Martin's shoulders, gave me a wary look, and the lot of them ran away around the corner. She was me. Except I was 13 when Kate took me off the streets. Suddenly, I wanted to go home. It scraped at me like claws, ripping through my resolve to the vulnerable, soft place I'd been trying to armor. I could picture it in my head. The sunlit kitchen. Curran gliding through the house, quiet like a ghost. Conlon leaping over the fence after running in the woods next door. The big, smelly poodle trailing him. And Kate standing in the kitchen, cooking something, her sword within reach. I wanted to go home and hug the three of them. I'd been gone for 8 years. Talking on the phone wasn't enough. Meeting Conlon in Roland's magic prison was nothing compared to getting a hug in person. I was so homesick, if I were a wolf, I would have howled. I needed to see my family and make sure they were okay. But if I did, they would die. I exhaled slowly, reasserting control. This city was bad for me. It was tearing wounds open that had long ago scabbed over. I was a princess of Shinar. More, I was the child Kate raised. People in our family didn't waste time feeling sorry for ourselves. We killed the monster blocking the front door so we could go home. I urged Tulaban, and she started down the street, light on her feet. Although many denominations, Methodist included, rejected holy relics, the existence of magical artifacts and relics was a fact. Some religious items had gained magical properties after the shift. Finding and selling these artifacts became a small but lucrative business and even spawned its own profession, relic hunters. These hunters were a rough crowd. These were people with nothing to lose, who crawled into abandoned temples, opened cursed tombs, and dug graves out of sacred ground at a time when myths proved real and phantom monsters turned flesh. They would do just about anything for a profit. According to Nick's file, Pastor Haywood had very few assets, so it was unlikely relic hunters had tried to sell him a magical artifact. Most likely, they'd wanted to know if the object they'd found was the real deal. As a man of his god, Pastor Haywood would have been able to recognize a relic of his deity and assess its power. I was looking for someone who had, or thought he had, a Christian holy item. The first step would be to contact Pastor Haywood's chain of command and see if they referred anyone to him. I didn't hold out much hope. Pastor Haywood was famous enough that someone might have found him even without a referral, but it was still worth a try. Unfortunately, all of that had to wait. I had to go home to put up wards, and I had to do it now. When I'd mentioned shapeshifters to Fleming, he didn't contradict me, and he didn't ask questions. A law enforcement officer who'd had no idea shapeshifters had trampled the crime scene he'd been guarding would want to know the details. Why did I think shapeshifters had been there? How many shapeshifters? When did they visit? Fleming had just let it drop. He must have owed the pack a favor, or he had taken their money. Either way, he would contact them the first chance he got. A team would be dispatched to the scene, and they would track me. There were ways to knock a shapeshifter off your scent. Wolfsbane worked well. It had the same effect on a shapeshifter as sticking your head into a bucket of pine pollen would have on a human. If a single shapeshifter was following my scent, using it might have been an option.
but I wouldn't be tracked by a single shapeshifter. I would be tracked by a team, so sanding my trail with Wolfsbane was futile. I might get the leading tracker, but the rest would just go around the Wolfsbane, spread out, and pick up my scent again. A confrontation with the pack's people was imminent, and I wanted to have it on my home turf, safe behind my wards. I'd been in Atlanta for less than a day. It was entirely too early to start killing people. I was in the decoy kitchen, sliding the first batch of cookies into the oven, when something brushed against the edge of my outer ward. It was almost 8 in the evening. Took them long enough. I'd cut through the central market on my way back. They must have had a devil of a time trying to follow my trail through the open-air market. Hard to track a scent after a horse peed on it. I draped the kitchen towel over my shoulder and walked to the front door, left open to vent the heat from the stove. The sunset burned across the sky, a gory, violent orange. I concentrated, sinking into my sensate vision. 3, 2, contact. Magic nipped at me. A bright green flash pulsed in the empty air and vanished. To the left, a dark four-legged shape jumped out from behind some rubble and dashed down the street, little more than a blur in the fading light. The shapeshifter who'd found my house, hurrying to report. I went back to the kitchen, sat at my strategically sad table, and waited. I felt spent. Fatigue wrapped around my shoulders like a heavy blanket. Too much magic expended too quickly this afternoon setting up the defensive perimeter. I'd learned the art of wards from my grandfather. Roland loved to teach, and I'd been hungry to learn. Later, my grandmother and her servants refined my education, but the foundation of my magic expertise was built by Roland. If you have to learn magic, studying under a brilliant megalomaniac wizard who thinks he's always right and can't wait to dazzle you with several millennia of knowledge was a really good choice. In the few hours since coming back from the central market, I'd set 3 concentric rings of wards. The outer ward, undetected by most of the people and creatures who crossed it, warned me that someone was coming, sampled the intruder's magic, and flashed it in a burst of color invisible to anyone who wasn't a sensate. The middle ward wrapped around the building, shielding the front entrance. I'd chosen a rune ward, a simple defensive barrier that relied on Elder Futhark runes carved on bone stakes driven into the ground. Solid, powerful, and common enough to not raise any eyebrows. It was also the first ward the Order's Academy taught to prospective knights, so it went along with my disguise. The third ward sealed off the hallway leading to the front bedroom and to the secret door, protecting the entire inner chamber. I had raised Enki's shield in 4 hours instead of the full 12 it usually required, and got a throbbing headache for my trouble. Still, Grandfather would be proud. I missed him. He was the monster in our family of monsters, but he was still my grandfather. If not by birth, then by choice. When my grandfather wanted to be liked, he was an unstoppable force, and he wanted me to like him. Roland wasn't bored in his prison. He was far too brilliant for that. But he planned to get out, and Colin and I were his link to the outside world. It had been over 6 weeks since my last visit. I was overdue. Magic pinched me. I peeked out of the kitchen in time to see the street light up with green through the doorway. Ascanio walked out of the shadows and strolled up to my house. I'd thought that trail of grass-green magic I'd noticed at the murder scene looked familiar. Someone from the pack was interested in Pastor Haywood's murder, and they'd sent Ascanio to figure it out. Why? Had this order come from the top, or was this a Clan Buddha affair? Was someone pulling his strings, or was he doing it on his own? All good questions. Ascanio was never big on following orders. It wouldn't be out of character for him to do this on his own, but he never acted without aiming for some sort of benefit. He knocked on my doorframe. I walked out of the kitchen into the front door. The shapeshifter hero. We meet again, and so soon. Ascanio froze. Before, I'd been on horseback, in the dark, a dozen yards away with my hood up. Now, less than 3 feet separated us. He could see my face, and it burned a fuse in his brain. For a moment, Ascanio forgot to be suave and simply stared with unnerving, focused intensity. My timer went off. Ascanio blinked.
Are you baking cookies?
Yes, I am. Excuse me. I went into the kitchen. Behind me, magic tolled through the house like a gong. Ascanio had tried to follow and walked right into my second ward. I pulled the batch of cookies out of the oven, slid the second tray in, reset my mechanical timer, and went back to the door. Ascanio leaned in the doorway, arms crossed, a slight smile on his lips. It had to be his sexy, nonchalant pose. I wasn't sure if I was expected to toss my underwear at his feet or just fall back with my legs in the air. He must have realized that he'd stared like an idiot and overcorrected, like a driver who drifted onto the shoulder and jerked the wheel trying to get back on the highway. Nice ward, he said. Keeps out the riffraff. A ruby light rolled over his irises. Can I have a cookie?
No.
He gave a mock sigh.
I have a feeling this conversation has gotten off to the wrong foot.
Not just a hero, but a master detective as well. I kept my voice quiet and friendly. In my head, I grabbed him and shook him until all the things I wanted to know about Pastor Haywood's murder fell out of his shockingly handsome head. He winked.
I'm not just a pretty face.
I don't recall saying you were pretty. The smile stayed on his lips, but his posture lost some of its slouching.
Let me tell you what I've detected.
I smiled back at him. I can't wait. Dazzle me. His gaze snagged on my lips. He blinked again. Lost your train of thought for a second there, buddy?
You pretended to be a lightweight on the bridge. You visited the Order, and you have an Order ID, which says you were assigned to Atlanta, except you're not, because the Atlanta chapter never has more than 20 knights, and with you, they are up to 21.
Fair enough.
You've used your brand new ID to gain access to a crime scene, but you aren't staying in the Order chapter. Instead, you're living in a hovel on the edge of the most dangerous area of the city, flirting with disaster and baking cookies with expensive chocolate chips.
Here it comes, the brilliant deduction. Ascanio hit me with a direct stare.
I have to ask why the Order is so invested in Pastor Haywood's murder that they would bring a knight crusader in for it.
It wasn't a bad assumption. When the Order had a particularly nasty mess on their hands, they threw a crusader at it, who would either clean it up and disappear, or die trying. Crusaders worked undercover, used unorthodox methods, and enjoyed a lot of leeway. If they screwed up, the Order had plausible deniability. Crusaders were dangerous as hell, and often crazy. They didn't do what they did for accolades. They did it because they believed in their cause. Before Nick Feldman became the Knight Protector, he was a crusader, one of the Order's best.
No answer?
I smiled at him again. Did you expect one? Ascanio pushed away from the doorway and looked past me, at my humble abode.
This place is a dump.
Thank you.
Whoever rented it to you should be barred from owning real estate. Nick should have never let you stay here.
Dropping the Knight Protector's name like you are bestest friends. I like it here. Quiet, picturesque. But now that you've visited, I'll have to put a no solicitors sign up front.
I'm not here to sell you anything, but I can offer you better accommodations. You're new to the city, and this really isn't a good neighborhood.
People keep telling me that.
Because it's true.
My timer went off again. Hold that thought. I went back to the kitchen, rescued my second batch, and turned the oven off. It was good that gas still burned even during the deepest magic waves.
I can put you in a better house, Ascanio called from the door. Free of charge.
Too crude for him. He was trying to gauge my reaction. I came back to the front and raised my head, inhaling deeply, the way shapeshifters did when they were trying to catch a scent on the breeze. His eyes widened.
"Do you smell that?" I asked him. "What's that odor? I can't quite place it."
He frowned. I opened my eyes wide. "Bribery, that's it." He recoiled with theatrical shock. "I come here. I offer you a safer place out of the goodness of my heart, and you accuse me of bribery."
"I have to ask why the Pack is so invested in Pastor Haywood's murder that they would send the Beta of Clan Buddha to investigate it, bribe the Atlanta PD to gain access to the crime scene, and then stalk and attempt to intimidate and coerce a Knight of the Order."
"I don't recall intimidating you. If I wanted to intimidate you, I would break through this ward." He smiled, showing me his sharp white teeth. "And take all of your cookies."
He promised to break the ward with complete confidence. That wasn't arrogance. That was experience talking.
The runic ward would stop an average shapeshifter, but then Ascanio Ferrara had never been average. All shapeshifters had two forms, one animal and the other human. Those with talent had a third, the warrior form, a blend of human and animal devastating in combat. Curran considered Ascanio's warrior form to be one of the best, a high compliment from a man who was once Beast Lord. Looked like I wasn't the only one who'd gotten stronger. I'd have to readjust my expectations. I went to the kitchen, took a cookie, whispered a bit of magic from a forgotten language into it, walked back to the door, and dropped the ward. Ascanio blinked. I held the cookie out to him. "You think it's the ward that's keeping me safe. You want this cookie? Take it." He studied me for a moment, his face calculating. He was lightning fast, and he was 99.9% sure he was faster than me. The cookie lay on my palm, waiting. Perfectly harmless. Ascanio's nostrils fluttered slightly. He was sampling the air looking for the scent of poison. Not that it would hurt him. Like V, the shapeshifter virus, ate poison for breakfast and asked for seconds. I sighed. "Do you want the cookie or not?" He moved so fast, his hand was a blur. His fingers touched the cookie and went right through it, brushing my palm, so light, like the tap of a moth's wing. When I was a street kid, I thought I had a light touch. I thought I was quick. Compared to Ascanio, I was a rank amateur. If I ever held something in my hand and he wanted it, I wouldn't even notice him taking it. Ascanio stared at the perfect